Oh, said the man. Well, I thought maybe.
The best way to keep the man talking, Edgar had learned, was to stay quiet and wait. He leaned the mirror back against the wagon and began collecting the broken china that lay around it and dropping the pieces into a chipped ceramic pan.
Whole years went by. I wasn't so happy here, the old man said. Most of the late 1950s in particular. The Eisenhower years. Bad times.
You were a farmer?
Yep.
Didn't you like farming?
Oh, gosh, I guess I hated it sometimes. Do you know how early you have to get up to milk cows? You get to them late, they try to step on your feet. They see you with the stool and the bucket at 10 in the morning, and you better be walking directly down the center of the aisle, because sure enough a 10-pound hoof is going to come striking out. They'll kick you squarely in the nuts if they think they got a shot at it. I know one fellow it happened to. He quit farming and moved to Chicago, as soon as he could walk again.
Edgar thought about this.
Was his name Schultz, by any chance?
No, one of the Kraus boys, the old man said. Anyway, just out of fear, if nothing else, you get up when it's pitch dark and they're still a little sleepy. You milk till your hands ache. Then you shovel out the stalls, which is no great treat. I was always amazed at just how much poop come out of a cow. Little hay goes in, huge cow pies come out. How's that happen?
I don't know much about cows, Edgar sighed after a long pause.
And that's just the work before breakfast, the man continued. Then there's planting and harvesting. Things breaking down. Calves birthed in big blue placentas with veins thick as your finger. Mastitis. Worms. You ever seen a cow magnet? Unbelievable. Looks like a giant metal bullet. You shove it right down the cow's throat, and a year or two later it comes out the other end covered with nails, bolts, hunks of wire. I know a man found his watch that way. We cut silage right up to the time snow flew, wondering if we were going to kill everything by putting it up wet. Fences broken, cows wandering in the woods. Some nights I'd come to the house so tired I didn't know if I could lift a fork to my mouth.
If you didn't like it, why didn't you quit?
To do what? Wasn't anything I knew better than farming. I was cursed, that was the problem. Just because I didn't like it didn't mean I wasn't good at it. I could call the weather, for instance. I'd walk outside one spring day and think, now we can plant. Down at the feed store they'd say, George, you're going to get frozen out. You put in too early, and you're going to lose 3/4 of it. But I had a sense. Always got it right, too. Even if snow fell, it was a dusting. Farmers around here started planting as soon as they heard I'd bought seed.
That doesn't sound like a curse to me.
It's a curse, all right. You're just too young to know about that sort of thing. To be good at something you don't care about? It isn't even unusual. Plenty of doctors hate medicine. Most of your businessmen lose their appetite at the sight of a receipt. It's a common thing. Old Bert down to town, he despises that grocery store. Says the routine bores him out of his mind. Ordering, stocking, worrying about produce going bad. One day he told me he dreams about tomatoes more than he dreams about his own wife.
What would you have done if you could have quit?
I'd have been a railroad engineer. Best job in the world. You turn a crank, and 10,000 tons of freight starts to move. You ever been inside a locomotive?
No.
I was up in Duluth once, and I went to the rail yards just to look at locomotives, and got to talking with a fella, and he knew one of the engineers walking by. He says, "Hey, Lem, come on over here." And this fella, he's dressed in overalls and a conductor's cap, just like you might see on television. He walks over. This man says, "Here's a gentleman never seen the inside of a locomotive."
"Is that right?"
Lem says. And he walks to a telephone and makes a call to someone. Maybe the trainmaster, I don't know. Then he hangs up. "Well, come on," he says. We start walking down the platform, past all the hopper cars and tankers and cabooses. And he says over his shoulder, "What you want to see? Steamer or diesel?" "Steamer," I says. And he leads me to engine number 6615. The number was painted in big letters on the side. It was one of them big ones. Cowcatcher like a bushy mustache. Covered with bolts the size of your head. Drive rods thick as your leg. Black, like it was carved out of a solid block of ore. He just points and names things. Air reservoir, cylinder, sandbox, steam dome, injectors, drive wheel. Then he scrambles up a ladder and motions me up, and we stand inside the cab. He keeps naming things off. Fire hole, reverser, regulator, throttle. That engine was cold and dead while we were standing in it. Lem said it was in for repairs. But even like that, a person could feel the power in it. The man's voice took on a wistful note. If there was ever a moment I was tempted to just walk away from it all, it was then, 1955. I was 50 years old. I stood there for a while, soaking it all up. Then Lem tells me to sit in the engineer's seat and lean out the window. You'd have to wear a cap and goggles if we were really running, he says. There'd be a stream of hot cinders going past the window. You know what happens if you're dumb enough to lean out uncovered, he says. Then he bends down and points to the right side of his face. It's all pocked with little burn scars, like old craters there in his skin. That's what, he says. But he was grinning like anything. I almost expected to see cinders stuck in his teeth. And from the look on his face, I could see he was one of the lucky ones. One of those people who like doing what they're good at. That's rare. When you see that in a person, you can't miss it. Edgar cautiously let his eyes drift over until the old farmer registered in his peripheral vision. He was standing with his chin dropped to his chest, lost in thought. "Now here's the thing," the man said, after a long time had passed. "When I sat in that seat and leaned out the window into the rain and imagined that stream of red-hot cinders going past my face like fireflies, watching a bridge coming up, which was my lifelong dream, do you know what I thought about? Your farm? That's right. There I was, sitting in a steam locomotive, one of the most beautiful engines ever devised. It was magnificent, big and heavy, and it made me think of a giant laid over sleeping. Ever since I was a boy, I'd thought running a train would be the most amazing thing ever, especially out in the open countryside, with the throttle screaming wide open, the whole world split by those two rails you're hurtling down. I could feel it. Even in that cold, dead engine, I could feel exactly what that would be like. And when I leaned out into the rain and the engineer told me about the sparks flying and he showed me his face, all I could think about was all the mud in the pasture. What cranky bitches the cows were going to be in the morning if they didn't get to pasture. And whether the mow roof was leaking. Now if that isn't a curse, the man said, what is? Before Edgar could answer, he heard Henry's car pulling up the drive. Edgar took off his gloves and walked into the sunshine. He had to kneel next to Tinder and put his hand against the dog's deep chest to restrain him as Henry climbed out of his car. And he and Tinder watched while Essay and Babu circled and jumped. That night, Henry offered to drive them into town. Edgar said no. But Henry had long since deduced that Edgar didn't want to be seen. He pointed out that they could drive around in relative safety after dark. The idea took Edgar by surprise. He was so used to traveling by day and bedding down at night, it hadn't occurred to him, not even when he'd stood looking at the car back at Scotia Lake. When nightfall came, he relented. They loaded the dogs into Henry's car, a brown sedan with a capacious but slippery back seat.
Edgar made Tinder sit on the floor up front. Babu and Essay scrabbled to balance themselves on the back seat.
"How long has it been since you've been in a car?"
Henry asked as he eased down the driveway. Then he looked alarmed.
"Oh, wait a second. When's the last time these dogs were in a car? Is this going to make them puke?"
Edgar shrugged, grinning.
"Great," Henry said. "You're cleaning it up if they do. Deal? Otherwise, I'm turning this thing around right now."
Before he could gripe any more, Babu leaned forward from the back seat and slobbered in Henry's ear.
"Oh, God," Henry said. "I hate it when they do that."
But he didn't really hate it. Edgar could see that. Anyone could see that. Out on the blacktop, they headed toward town. The headlights caught dandelions leaking up through the cracks in the asphalt. They passed a culvert over a creek where the moon's reflection wobbled between the cattails. Lute was a crossroads town, its one intersection controlled by a stoplight swinging like a lantern from crisscrossed wires. On each corner sat matching two-story brick buildings, like four old-timers crouched around a pan of beans. A Rexall drug, Mike's Bar and Grill, a True Value Hardware, and the Lute Grocery.
"Closed up tight after 5, Henry said, waving a hand at the buildings. "Society life begins at 6:30 when Mike's opens."
On that night, society life consisted of the three cars in the tavern's small parking lot, lit by the otherworldly glow of the Pabst Blue Ribbon sign. "Finest beer served anywhere," hanging over the door. On the far side of town, the pale chambered heart of the Lute Water Tower hovered in the night sky, tethered to the earth by four metal legs and the central stalk of its drainpipe. Once in the countryside, they drove without destination, wherever Henry wanted to go, and Henry wanted to go north. Henry liked to drive fast. That surprised Edgar, but pleased him, too. He'd forgotten the weight of acceleration. They coursed along a maze of back roads. Essay and Babu slid across the slick back seat when Henry powered around curves. Marshes and forests and lakes flashed by. Tinder craned his neck to see out the window. Headlights approached like balls of white flame. Their speed compressed the scent of the night into a dense algal perfume that roared through the windows. Henry spun the radio dial, looking for distant AM stations, Chicago, Minneapolis, Little Rock. The signal cracked with the heat lightning over Lake Superior. At the outskirts of Ashland, with its downtown lights and police cars, Henry swung the car onto the shoulder and shot away from town by an entirely different route, past shanties set back from the road. He paused by a bog that glowed eerily when he shut the headlights off. When they arrived at the railroad tracks, Edgar looked at the bluff to his right and realized they'd made the round trip. They retired to a pair of lawn chairs. Henry drank a beer and then another, and then he walked to the old wreck of a car.
"Tell you a secret," he said. "This car was here when I moved in. I may have bought the place just to get the car."
This was certainly news to Edgar. He'd been walking past the vehicle for days without deeming it worthy of a closer look. It sported a broad hood and headlights shaded by exaggerated brow ridges. The front fender sloped toward the rear wheels in a long arc, while a compensating ridge developed into a tail fin. But whatever grace of form the car had once possessed was gone. Its body was so thoroughly dented, it looked as if someone had beaten it, savagely, with its own tire iron. Rust had consumed major continents from the rear quarter panels. The chrome of the elaborate two-tiered front bumper was dull as ore. And, of course, the vehicle lacked tires. It levitated above the gravel on shadowy cinder blocks. All in all, the car gave the impression of an animal that had crawled to within inches of its lair before expiring.
"The vehicle at which you are now looking, at?"
Henry said. sweeping his arm as if addressing an awestruck crowd, "is a 1957 Ford Fairlane Skyliner, the first retractable hardtop convertible ever made in America. No car looked like it before or since. Even the 58 looks different. Ford messed up this beautiful bumper and grille for no reason. This is one of a kind." Henry patted the car's side mirror with pride. It fell away and dropped to the ground.
"Darn it," he said.
He snatched up the mirror and jiggled the bolts back into the corroded holes.
"It's a little dinged up," he said, "but watch this."
He opened the driver's side door and pulled a lever, and the trunk popped open, hinged backward near the rear bumper. Henry wrenched the trunk hood up, casually at first, then applying more effort, grunting and scrabbling his feet against the gravel. He circled the car, unsnapping latches. The metal roof separated from the body. It folded halfway into the trunk and then caught.
"This is supposed to be electric," Henry said over his shoulder, "but there's no battery."
Then he reached into the back seat, withdrew a hammer, and beat unmercifully on a hinge. The roof dropped into the trunk cavity with a final metallic screech that temporarily silenced the night birds. Henry slammed the trunk shut and turned to Edgar, triumphant but panting.
"So you see why I can't just sell this car? There's so much potential here. Some guy offered to buy it for parts last summer, but I couldn't let it be torn apart. I explained all that to Belva, but it made zero impression. She said it was an eyesore, which, I admit, okay, it is, now. But ordinary? I don't think you can say that."
Henry had gotten himself wound up talking about the Skyliner, but he stopped and shook off the idea with a shake of his head.
"Who am I trying to kid?" he said.
"No," Edgar sighed. "You're right. It isn't ordinary." Henry peered at him, gisting the sign.
"You think?"
Edgar nodded.
"I can never tell anymore," he said. "When my guard is down, I forget. I slide right back to ordinary, and I don't even see it."
He walked to the lawn chairs, and together they contemplated the Skyliner.
"I almost took you to the police station tonight, Nat," he said. "You probably should know that."
Edgar shook his head and smiled.
"No, you didn't." "Oh, yes, there was a moment when I thought, all I have to do is turn left at the next stop, and we'll be at the Ashland police station."
"The shed's not done."
"Yeah, the shed saved you," Henry said. "This time. Better figure out how to stretch things out, is my advice."
They'd reached the limit of Henry's ability to read sign, and Edgar picked up the newspaper.
"You couldn't have forced us inside," he wrote. "We'd have just run."
"How could you run with Tinder?" Edgar didn't know what to say to that. He wouldn't have gotten into the car with Henry if he hadn't trusted him. There were moments when Edgar understood Henry better than Henry understood himself. What Henry couldn't see was that, ordinary or not, he was trustworthy. That much was clear as day. On Sunday, they worked in the shed side by side, tackling the items that took two people to move, like the wringer washer and the old furnace. Henry connected a hose out to the spigot on the house and started a fire in the burning barrel. They fed it old newspapers, gray split fence posts with stringers of barbed wire that glowed red, busted up wooden chairs. Henry chopped the wagon's tongue in two with an axe and upended the halves, hardware and all, into the barrel. A gout of orange cinders flew into the air. By the time the fire settled, it was late in the day. They sat on the stoop eating potato chips and looking at the remaining debris.
"I know a trailer we can use to haul this stuff away," Henry said. "Maybe I can get it next weekend."
"Your car doesn't have a hitch," Edgar wrote on the newspaper.
Before he handed it over, he completed 14 down in the crossword puzzle. A 10-letter word for a short movement connecting the main parts of a composition. The second letter was N, and it ended with O. Henry looked at the word Edgar had written, intermezzo. He squinted over at him. "You ever think about entering a contest or something?" Edgar shook his head. "Well, you ought to. And a person can rent hitches." Tinder limped over. Henry was a soft touch for treats, and as soon as Tinder began crunching a chip, Babu started working Henry over. Edgar finally told them both to stop. A rapport was developing between Henry, Babu, and Tinder. Only Esse stayed aloof. She didn't mind Henry, that was just how she was. With Esse, more than with any other dog Edgar had known, trust was something you had to earn. That week, he scraped flakes of paint from the sides of the shed and caulked the holes. Henry had purchased barn red paint for the outside. Inside, it was to be whitewashed. Applying whitewash was lonely work. The old farmer had stopped appearing as soon as the last of the junk was out. The days were hot, and the skies filled with monumental clouds. Late each afternoon, Henry turned his sedan up the driveway. When he got out of the car, he squatted and let the dogs wash his face, then inspected Edgar's progress. "It's a pretty good color," he said, after Edgar finished painting the exterior. "Makes the house look shabby, though." Nights, they went on careening drives, Henry glowering and accelerating through curves while tree trunks strobed past and the dogs slid across the back seat. When they returned, Henry cracked a beer and gravitated to the Skyliner. Often he ended up sitting behind the wheel. Tinder would limp over and scramble onto the seat alongside him. And somewhere along the line, between the crossword puzzles and the records from the library and the beer, Henry asked Edgar to teach him about the dogs. They went out after dinner, and Edgar taught him a few signs. Then he and Esse demonstrated something simple, guided fetches. He put two sticks on the ground and asked Esse to go to them. It was a variation on the shared gaze exercises, and all the dogs knew how it worked. When Esse reached the targets, she looked back at Edgar. When he looked at the stick on the left, she snatched it and brought it to him, tail swinging. Edgar took the stick and ran a hand across Esse's cheek. After another demonstration with Babu, it was Henry's turn. He chose to work with Tinder. A good choice. Something about the dog's injury and enforced convalescence had taught Tinder an extra measure of patience, which he needed because at first Henry was hopeless. And yet the dog persevered, as if he had decided to take on Henry as a personal project. At times, Tinder even forgot about his foot and stopped limping for a few steps. To begin with, Henry's sign was vague, neither a recall nor a release nor a request to go out. But Tinder got the idea and walked to the sticks. There was no skill involved in the next step, and yet somehow Henry managed to confuse the dog, who patiently didn't pick up either target, but stood waiting. Then, for some reason, Henry gave the release command again. Tinder's ears dropped. Henry walked forward. He was about to lift the stick up to Tinder's mouth in desperation when Edgar stepped in and gave the command correctly and looked at the rightmost stick. Tinder snatched it off the ground at once. Edgar forked two fingers sternly at Henry's eyes. "Watch the target. They know the difference." "Okay, okay." Henry took the stick from Tinder, forgetting to thank him, and set it on the ground. Edgar let this breach of etiquette slide, and they retreated. When Henry started to sign a release instead of a go-out, Edgar grabbed his hands and moved them until the sign had been correctly formed. Henry blushed, but the next time he signed the request perfectly. Without hesitation, Tinder limped across the lawn, looked at Henry, and brought him the target. And at that moment, Henry got it, whatever it was. the difference between commanding Tinder and working with him. When Henry had signed that go-out, he looked at Tinder instead of his hands. When Tinder checked back, he'd trusted the dog to read his face. And then the cascade of revelations began, just as it had for Edgar. He could tell by the expression on Henry's face. Edgar thought of all those letters between Brooks and his grandfather, the endless argument about companionship and work, how his grandfather had argued that there was never a difference, how Brooks, in exasperation, had refused to discuss it further. He thought, too, of the question his mother had posed to him a million years before. What were they selling, if not dogs? And there stood Henry Lamb, beaming. Until that moment, Edgar had never seen the man smile without some fatalistic reserve that said he knew the joke would ultimately be on him. And though Edgar was no closer to putting it into words, for the first time he was sure he knew the answer to his mother's question. "Where were you heading, anyway?" Henry said. It was later that night, and they sat at the kitchen table. "I'm not trying to pry. Don't answer if you don't want to." "It's okay," Edgar signed. He jotted Star Child Colony on a sheet of paper and handed it to Henry. What was interesting was that before the words had appeared on the paper, he hadn't been sure himself what his answer would be. At least not to say it so flatly that way. But he'd always been veering northwest, hadn't he? To get past the tip of Lake Superior? And then start the walk along the lakeside to sneak past the Canadian border? Then somehow find the place? That had been the plan. Alexandra Honeywell had said they needed people. People who were willing to work hard. He was willing to work hard. So that's where they had been going. Henry whistled. "The place on the news? Alexandra, what's her name? Up by Thunder Bay?" Edgar nodded. "You know somebody there?"
"No."
"Anyone know you're coming?"
"No."
Henry shook his head.
"That's a couple hundred miles. What were you going to do, walk the whole way?"
Edgar shrugged.
"I guess you could. I'm not sure what a person would do for food."
Edgar scuffled his feet at the memory of looting Henry's kitchen.
"Can Tinder make it on that foot?"
And that was the question, wasn't it? Tinder's foot wasn't bandaged anymore, but mornings the dog gimped badly. Edgar didn't know when Tinder would be ready, if ever. He shrugged his shoulders. There was no answer except to try. On Friday, Henry arrived home with a trailer hitched to the sedan. He got out and he knelt and, grinning at Edgar, let the dogs accost him. He gestured at the trailer where four inflated tires lay. "I had retreads put on the wheels for the Skyliner. Tomorrow she's going to roll for the first time in, 15 years. He pulled a bag of groceries from the passenger seat of his car. "Chicken on the spit and potato salad," he said. "Ordinary or not ordinary?"
"Ordinary," Edgar signed. "But good."
They started the grill and put the chicken on and sat in the lawn chairs and looked out at the piles of junk. "I've almost got used to seeing it there," Henry said. "Putting the Skyliner in the shed, ordinary or not ordinary?"
"Not ordinary," Edgar signed.
"Just checking," Henry said. He was working a crossword puzzle. "Six-letter word meaning to stamp a coin. Starts with Q."
Edgar looked at him.
"I don't know."
"Gotcha," he said.
"Only joking, it starts with an I."
He handed the newspaper over to Edgar.
"In Q's,"
Edgar wrote on the paper and handed it back.
"Jesus," Henry said. "That's just plain scary."
The next day they jacked up the Skyliner, mounted the tires, and dragged the cinder blocks away.
"Oh, man," Henry said. "Oh, boy. Hold on, wait a second."
He ran to the barn, returned with a hammer, and folded the car's top into the trunk again. When he finished, they coaxed all three dogs onto the front seat. It took the better part of an hour, laboriously pushing the car back and forth to align it in front of the shed. The dogs had long since abandoned ship.
"Come back!" Henry cried as they fled. "That's an honor!"
Then they pushed the car into the shed. Henry ran around front to keep it from rolling into the wall, since the brakes didn't work.
"Careful," he said. "Just a little more."
And then the Skyliner was inside. They closed the now bright red doors, and Henry dropped the bolt through the flap latch. Henry fetched a beer and began to walk through the piles of junk sitting in the yard, scratching his head. He looked at the mirror and the stanchions.
"Geez, that's a shame," he said.
Over a broken porcelain sink, he moaned. "Whoa, just imagine what happened to that." He walked to the stoop and sat down.
"I can't do it," he said.
"Can't do what?"
"Haul that stuff away. It was here before I was."
He took a long swallow from the beer and held it up to the light.
"Putting that stuff back in the shed, ordinary or not ordinary?"
Edgar looked at him.
"I don't know."
Henry made the decision. They worked like maniacs. Not everything could go back in, but they rehung the hubcaps and the old tools on the walls. They found space on the rafters to lay the salvageable sheets of plywood. Edgar handed up the old broken sink and the pruning shears, and they leaned two of the stanchions in a corner. When they had finished, the mirror graced the front wall of the shed, reflecting the Skyliner's broad front bumper, and two of the wagon wheels leaned against the outside like wreaths of gray wood. The shed was jammed full. The Skyliner could roll out, but with inches to spare.
"That's it," Henry said, stepping back to look at what they'd done. "That feels right."
It did feel right, Edgar thought. He watched the dogs sniff the wagon wheels as Henry backed the trailer up to the gravel apron. They hefted the old furnace and the transmission and the wringer washer onto its bed.
"What say we celebrate with a little ride?" Henry said.
Edgar shook his head.
"Not in the daylight." "Oh, come on, lighten up. Nothing bad's gonna happen."
Maybe it was the idea of Henry Lamb telling him to lighten up that made the request seem reasonable.
"All right," he signed. "Okay."
They unhitched the trailer, piled into the car, and barreled through the waves of heat rising over the blacktop. Henry took them daringly through the middle of Ashland, and Edgar felt, if not entirely carefree, more light-hearted than he had in a long time. They were heading back toward the open highway when the light on the railroad crossing started to flash, and the thin, striped crossing arms levered down. Henry brought the sedan to a stop, and a flush of adrenaline went through Edgar. He slid down until he was hidden from the cars around them. That was safe enough, he thought. A man with three dogs in his car wasn't that unusual. The train lumbered past. The crossing lights flashed and the bells pounded. Edgar lifted his head to see if the caboose was visible yet, then ventured to look around. A young woman sat alone in the car next to them. Edgar tapped Henry's arm and pointed.
"Holy cow," Henry said. "That's Belva. Act natural."
Edgar wasn't sure what Henry meant by that. Edgar was acting natural. The dogs were acting natural. Henry, however, had immediately stopped acting natural. He sat ramrod straight and began whistling a little nervous toot-de-toot-toot and drumming his fingers on the steering wheel as if some pounding rock and roll ballad were playing on the radio, though in fact it was the weather forecast. "Partly cloudy today," the announcer droned. "Chance of severe thunderstorms tomorrow." Harvest weather, Edgar thought. The woman must have glanced over and noticed Henry, for when Edgar lifted his head to look again, she too was turned forward, looking intently ahead. The train kept rolling along, car after car. There was plenty of time to read the letters and numbers on the sides. Finally, the woman leaned over and rolled down her passenger side window and shouted, "Henry!" Henry turned and looked at her, still whistling.
"Toot, toot, toot."
"Belva!" he shouted back.
"I've been meaning to call you."
"Is that right?" Henry said. He glanced at Edgar and gave a little wink.
"I guess you saw the sunflowers."
"What?"
"The sunflowers. I guess you saw the sunflowers."
"What sunflowers?"
"Oh," he said. "Never mind."
"I'm moving," she shouted.
"What?"
"Moving. I'm moving to Madison."
"How come?"
"Why are there all those dogs with you?" she shouted, instead of answering his question.
"Oh, I don't know,"
Henry said lamely. He pounded a fist on the steering wheel and looked down at Edgar, scooched below the windows.
"Ordinary," Edgar signed up at him.
"Right," Henry muttered. He turned back to Belva.
"I just decided to get a dog. Three dogs."
"Wow," she said. "They're really nice."
"Very ordinary," Edgar signed, rolling his eyes.
"Actually, they belong to my nephew," he corrected. "I'm just looking after them."
She laughed again.
"You don't have any nephews, Henry. You're an only child."
He looked stricken for a moment.
"What's that?" No, not nephew. Nathu. They belong to my friend Nathu. Say hello, Nathu."
He waved Edgar up from the floorboards. Edgar shook his head.
"Come on," he hissed. "Help me out here."
"No." "Who are you talking to?" Belva shouted.
Nobody, just the dogs," he said.
"Why are you moving to Madison?"
There was a long pause, and Edgar could hear the clank of the joints between the train cars, and the clang-clang of the crossing gates, and, even faintly, radios playing in the cars around them. The dogs were looking out the windows, panting happily. Babu, in particular, seemed interested in Belva. He pushed his head out the driver's side window to get a better look.
"Well," she shouted at last, "because Joe is. Joe, my fiancé."
"Ah," Henry said.
"Uh-huh. Oh.
You did know I was engaged, right?"
"Yes, of course. It was in the paper."
"Yep, that's where I saw it," he said.
"I bet he's a moron."
"What?"
"I said, I bet you love Madison."
"Really, Henry, who's in the car with you?"
Henry looked over at Edgar. Beads of sweat stood out on his forehead.
"Come on," he hissed. "Just this once."
Then the caboose rattled past, and Edgar thought he could probably risk it that one time. The guard arms were already lifting, and they were about to drive away. He was being silly hiding under the dash like that. He sat up. He waved hello to Belva. And that was when he looked through the rear window of Henry's sedan and noticed the State Patrol cruiser. Glenn Papineau. Glenn Papineau supposed he was in mourning. He had used that word before, even thought he understood what it meant, but he really hadn't. For one thing, mourning sounded like a formality, a stage a person was required to go through, wearing a black suit and attending a funeral. But real mourning didn't end the day after the funeral, or the week after, or even the month after. His pop had died nearly 2 months earlier, and sometimes Glenn felt like he'd just then gotten the call. In his mind, he called them the day feeling and the night feeling. The day feeling caught up with him before lunch most days, a hot blanket of lethargy so suffocating it made his temples pound. He dragged himself around work as if facing a high wind. Everything took an eternity, became a laborious detail. and Glenn hated details. He was built for broad gestures. All the person had to do was look at his hands to know that. A man with hands like Glenn's would do certain things, and certain other things would never be in the cards. He'd never be a pianist, for example, or a veterinary surgeon. Not that he wanted those things. It was just that he found himself looking at his hands a lot lately, and his hands said they weren't there for detail work. The day feeling was bad, no question, but the night feeling was the real killer. A bleak sledgehammer to the soul, as if some stranger had whispered a terrible secret in his ear, and that secret was how death was senseless and inevitable. The knowledge made sleep impossible. He sat up, watching television, and if he didn't want to be alone, he went to the taverns. Not the smartest move for local law enforcement to drink in public, but people understood. Some even bought him beers and told him stories about his pop. There were moments of acceptance. After all, his pop had been getting up in years, and Glenn had contemplated his death more than once, though he'd imagined something long and slow, a tangle with cancer, an unnameable decline. What he hadn't expected was that death's visit would be so sudden. One day he'd been a vigorous 67-year-old man, running his clinic, flirting with the bakery ladies, blabbering to anyone who would listen about his winter vacation in Florida, and the next he was lying at the bottom of the stairs in the Sawtelle's barn. Glenn, as an only child, had been responsible for the funeral arrangements. There had been a detailed will specifying that his father be buried alongside Glenn's mother in Park City. At the shop, as his father called the veterinary clinic, Glenn had boxed his father's desk, his books, the jackets hanging on the hooks. Jeannie had called all his father's clients and referred them to Dr. Howe in Ashland. The will specified that the vet school in Madison be contacted and his practice be sold in toto rather than auctioned off. But no one seemed terribly interested in a practice in the hinterlands, and Glenn had gotten no serious calls. The shop stood dark and silent now, pharmacy locked down, plastic sheets thrown over everything as if it were a morgue. The place was a break-in waiting to happen, Glenn thought. In fact, someone had already put a rock through one of the back windows, though nothing was missing. So there was the day feeling and the night feeling, and those were bad, and he was drinking a little more than he used to. But Glenn thought he was handling things, if not thriving, until Claude called and said he wanted to talk. Glenn offered to come out to the Sawtelle place, but Claude suggested the Kettle, a tavern south of town. The Brewers were playing on the television when Glenn walked in. Claude hailed him from the end of the bar. The bartender, Adam, drew him a Leinenkugel, and Glenn sat down next to Claude. They watched the game and talked about Pop, how Claude remembered him coming out of the kennel back when he was a kid. Claude said some nice things about his pop. He said that, besides Glenn, he thought he was probably the closest thing to family Pop had. Said he thought of Glenn's father as an uncle, which meant a lot because the Sawtelles were a small family. It was much later when they got to Claude's reason for calling. Dr. Howe was incompetent, Claude said. Until they found another vet, Claude intended to do the workaday medicine himself, worming the pups, treating mastitis, and so on. He'd been a medic in the Navy, and he knew his way around a medicine chest. Glenn knew his father had some sort of arrangement with the Sawtelles, since it wasn't practical to be running out there 5 days a week just to prescribe penicillin. So they had set aside a medicine chest in their barn for the supplies Pop usually locked up in his office. And now Claude wondered if Glenn would be willing to sell off some of the meds in the shop pharmacy, seeing as no one was beating down the door to take over. They were 4 or 5 beers in at that point, which wasn't much for someone Glenn's size, but he'd also had a couple before he drove down. They watched the Brewers give up another run. Adam swore at the television as a service to the bar patrons. "You know what I think about when I think about your dad?" Claude said. "The Hot Mix Duck Massacre." Glenn chuckled.
Yeah, that first rain. Remember all those ducks quacking around the shop?
When Glenn was 8 years old, the state had come through and repaved Main Street and put up streetlights. The first significant improvement that Mellon had seen on its long glide toward oblivion after its lumbering heyday since Truman was in office. The streets had been so bad, the town kids made a game out of riding bicycles down the street without crossing any pothole patches. It wasn't easy. In some places, it hadn't even been possible. But instead of the pebbly tar and gravel asphalt that had once covered the street, the state crew had applied a new formula that went down like black smoking glue and hardened pudding smooth. This was called hot mix, presumably because they poured it from a huge wheeled furnace. The hot mix furnace stank to high heaven for the 3 weeks it took to resurface the street, but it was a small price to pay. Afterward, Mellon's previously pocked Main Street was a pristine strip of smooth black pavement. Things were hunky-dory until the first rainy spell. One night, a couple of ducks flew by, looking for a spot to land on the Bad River. With the new streetlights shining off the rain-slick hot mix, Main Street must have looked like a placid, fish-filled stream, more inviting than the Bad River had ever been. The first two ducks came in for a water landing, quacking like mad, and broke their necks on impact. Then the main flock came up over the trees, their tiny bird brains unable to figure out why their compatriots looked so odd there in the water. The result had been known ever after as the Hot Mix Duck Massacre. The luckiest birds tumbled head over heels, shook their bills in confusion, and flapped off. But a half-dozen others became dinner for quick-thinking observers. The rest suffered all manner of injuries. The diner emptied. A strange roundup of the wounded ensued. People herded limping, stunned ducks into boxes, captured them under blankets, even shooed them into cars. A caravan had arrived at Glenn's father's shop.
"They got so they limped around behind Pop wherever he went," Glenn said.
Claude had forgotten some of the details, but as they drank and talked, he'd gone from grinning to laughing out loud at Glenn's recollection.
"Yep. What I remember best is him setting them on the receptionist counter," Claude said, "and talking to people as if he couldn't see them. What duck?" he'd say. "I used to fall down laughing when he did that."
Glenn remembered that, too. That was back when Claude had worked around the shop doing odd jobs. He remembered thinking back then what a striking figure Claude was. A bit of a hero to Glenn, in fact. He'd been athletic. He still looked good for, what, 40? And another thing, Claude always seemed to have a girlfriend, which, even back when he was 8, Glenn suspected might turn out to be a problem for him.
"Did I ever tell you what he did at the diner?" Glenn said.
"What's that?"
"One time when the splints were off and he knew those ducks would do just about anything for him, he put one in an old medicine bag and closed it up and went to the diner for lunch. He set the bag on the seat in the booth and waited. The duck never made a sound. Pop ordered first, and while the waitress was taking my order, he reached over and opened the bag and out popped the duck's head."
"No,"
Claude said, laughing.
"When I finished, he said, 'Aren't you going to take his order?' And she saw the duck and screamed."
"No."
"Yes. Dropped her order pad and everything.
And you know what the duck did?"
"What?"
"It jumped out of the case and chased her back to the kitchen, gabbling at her heels. She hollered the whole way."
Claude was shaking and holding onto the rim of the bar as if he were about to fall off his stool.
"Pop shouted back that his friend wanted the smelt."
"Oh, God."
"He said he wouldn't put the duck back into the bag until it was done eating. That even ducks had a right to a decent lunch, especially in Mellon."
"Stop," Claude begged. "Please, stop."
Tears were streaming down his face. Glenn liked being able to make Claude laugh like that. He hadn't quite realized what a funny story it made, but Claude had really given himself over to mirth, and Glenn found it impossible not to laugh along with him. When Claude finally wiped his eyes, he ordered another round, and they clanked their glasses.
To Paige. To Pop.
Whatever happened to those ducks?
I don't remember, Glenn confessed. They never could fly again. I think Pop gave them to a farmer down by Prentice.
They watched the game for a bit longer, and then Glenn bought a six-pack to go, and they headed for the shop. Claude followed in his Impala. Glenn walked up to the dark side door and pulled out a set of keys, drunkenly trying one after another. Inside, he flipped a switch, and a bank of unearthly fluorescence flickered into service overhead. The pharmacy was nothing more than a neatly organized closet beside his pop's office. Glenn unlocked it, swung the door open, and stepped back.
What were you looking for?
Claude stepped inside and carefully examined the shelves of bottles and vials, pausing two or three times to look at labels more closely, almost as if window shopping rather than just looking for the penicillin. When he had finished his detailed scrutiny of the pharmacy's contents, he pulled three containers from the rack.
This, he said, handing one across to Glenn. This and this.
He stepped out and let Glenn shut the door.
If you know where the sales slips are, I'll write these up, he said.
Take them. It'd cost more to tell the lawyer than to just give them to you.
Well, thanks, Claude said. Maybe I can find a way to make it up to you.
No need, he said, waving a broad hand at Claude. Forget it.
They walked outside and locked up and walked to the cars. Glenn reached into the back seat and pulled out two beers, and they stood looking into the night sky. Then the silence turned clumsy. Glenn knew Claude had more on his mind than just medication. The fact was, Glenn had been in touch with Claude and Trudy quite a lot over the last 2 months. The night his father had died, Edgar had run off with a couple of the dogs. It was more than the kid could take, seeing two men die in the same room. At first they thought he was hiding in the woods. Then they expected to spot him hitchhiking. That's what happened to most kids who ran off. Each morning the highway patrol broadcast a list of runaways picked up, but there was never a match. Of course, Glenn had worked the grapevine around Mellon. Walt Graves, who delivered RFD mail, made a point to talk to everyone on his route. At the telephone office, Glenn had hinted that the switchboard operators might place an anonymous call if they heard something interesting on a party line. The Forest Service had briefly run a search plane. But in the end, Edgar was just another runaway, and there wasn't much to do except wait for him to turn up, then ship him home. And so, without being asked, Glenn said,
"You know I'd call right off if something came through."
Claude sipped his beer in silence and looked thoughtful.
"Most runaways, the ones that aren't trying to get away from some sort of bad situation at least, come home on their own before it gets cold. He'll either get picked up or show up."
"Yep," Claude said. And then, after a while, "Just between you and me, though, I'm not sure that would be such a good thing.
Maybe he's better off run away.
You can't imagine the torment that boy has put Trudy through in the last 9 months. He's got something in him. Well, he's wild."
"He's getting to be that age. Plus, he must have been awfully shook up about Gar. When I talked with him, he couldn't remember much of what happened."
That got Claude's attention.
"Trudy mentioned that, too," he said. "How did that work, anyway? Did he recall anything about the day at all, or was it just a pure blank?"
"Oh, sure, lots of stuff. What he was doing with the dogs, what he ate for breakfast. But the closer we got to the moment he found Gar, the sketchier things got."
"Uh-huh,"
Claude said. Now he was peering at Glenn intently.
"I always thought that was strange, the way he just found him. I haven't wanted to ask Trudy about it, stir up bad feelings.
But are you telling me he didn't hear anything? Gar calling for help, the dogs barking, anything like that?
Not when he talked. That was the next day. Technically, I should have talked with him right away, but Pop got a little mad when I suggested it. He was sure it could wait, and I could see for myself the kid was a wreck. Glenn shrugged and took another swallow of beer. Could be different now, though. People remember things after a while.
I suppose, Claude said. But how would you know those memories are for real? You get them months later.
Glenn thought about Claude saying Edgar had something wild in him. He looked over at Claude.
If I recall the rumors, you were pretty wild yourself once. Maybe it just runs in the family.
Claude nodded.
I had my moments. Not so much at his age, but I know what you're saying. I don't fault him for wildness, but with Edgar, it's different.
Glenn looked at him.
Different? How?
Well, I got wild the way most boys get wild. I wanted to shake things up. I thought everything needed shaking up. I never set out to hurt anybody. With Edgar, though, I don't know. He can't always control his temper.
Then Cloud stopped. He looked like he was searching for words. He took a long swallow of beer.
I don't know how to tell you this, he said, but on the other hand, I don't like keeping secrets either.
Tell me what?
About your pop.
What about him? I suppose you're going to tell me that he was a hellraiser, too.
Glenn laughed at the idea. If his father hadn't been a veterinarian, he would have been a schoolteacher, more likely a principal. He liked being an authority figure, the one who told people what was what.
No, nothing like that, Claude said. You understand, everything I'm going to tell you is secondhand. I wasn't there when it happened, okay? I was in the house, and the first thing I really saw with my own eyes was when I walked into the barn and Paige was lying there.
And then, though it was a warm summer night, Glenn felt a chill.
Thing is, after Edgar ran off, I found out from Trudy that Paige didn't just trip. It sounds like he fell down those stairs because Edgar was coming after him.
There was a long silence, during which blood began to pound in Glenn's ears.
Coming after him?
Yeah.
You mean coming after him to hit him?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Why would he do that?
Well, that's the part we don't understand. After Gar died, he clammed up. And when Edgar wants to clam up, there isn't a thing anyone can do about it. That night, we were talking to a breeder interested in operating a branch kennel. Had some interesting ideas about approaching the Carruthers catalog people. That really disturbed Edgar. He opened up that big mow door and dragged Trudy over to it and nearly pushed her out. Who knows what would have happened if he hadn't stopped?
Plus, he was none too happy about me spending so much time out there, which I suppose I can understand.
Fact is, most nights he slept out in the mow, like that was his place instead of in the house.
Claude, Glenn said, for Christ's sake.
I don't know, Glenn. Maybe Trudy got it wrong. It's not my place to tell you this anyway. I've gone over it and over it in my mind, and no matter how you slice it, it was a freak accident. Pick up the Milwaukee Journal tomorrow and check the obituaries. I bet you $50 you find someone who died in some sort of freak accident. Remember when Odin Kunkler fell out of his apple tree trying to shake a porcupine off a branch? He could have broke his neck instead of both arms. Who knows what made the difference? Even if Trudy had it right, Edgar didn't touch your pop. He just ran at him and Paige fell.
That's still manslaughter, Glenn said.
Besides.
Besides what?
Well, I didn't know if you were all that close to your dad. Some people are glad when the old man's gone.
Oh, God. Ah, shit. Jesus fucking Christ, Claude. We had some words sometimes, who doesn't? But he was my father.
Glenn looked at Claude to see if he meant to provoke him, but Claude looked genuinely sincere. If anything, a little puzzled by the vehemence of Glenn's reaction.
Uh-huh, well, it isn't always that way. Between father and son, I mean. I wasn't sure.
Well, now you know.
No offense intended, okay? I'm just telling you to be straight. I think a person needs to keep things above board, Claude said. Look, if you wanted to, you could sue us. After all, your dad was on our property. He did fall down our stairs. Whether Edgar scared him into falling or not probably wouldn't even come into it. The right lawyer would just argue that we didn't do something we should have, like we didn't have good enough handrails or whatnot. Though there is a handrail.
Don't be ridiculous.
Well, maybe, but the point is, I was always taught that in a case like this, where nothing is black and white, we'd have to be the ones to decide what's right. I'm not talking about courts. I mean, the people themselves decide. But if you want legal justice, there it is. You could shut down the kennel if you wanted. No more sawtail dogs ever again. That's got to be your decision, and that's okay. I can't speak for Trudy, of course. She's awfully dependent on those dogs now, especially with Edgar run off. I have to argue with her to place every single one.
I don't want that, and you know it.
Don't you? Wait and see. Maybe tomorrow you'll wake up discouraged and depressed. That's the way these things work. You won't be angry, not then, just laid out, like all the wind's been taken out of your sails. But the day after that, or the day after that, you might wake up and before you have a chance to think about it, you'll get dressed and head over to your pop's place, out the door and down the street, before you remember your pop is gone for good. And that's when it'll hit you. That's when you're going to get angry. It'll be over some little thing that really doesn't matter. So don't tell me what sort of justice you want, Glenn. It's a promise you can't keep.
Well, I can tell you this much. I'm not going to sue you and Trudy for something Edgar did.
Why the hell not? Claude said. He's a minor. Trudy's his mother, and I'm his uncle. Trudy raised him. She must have done something wrong, or he wouldn't have come after Paige.
No, it doesn't work that way. Well, maybe it does. I don't know. I mean, think about me. I was a mixed bag at best. But Pop, he did the best he could. There wasn't one time he didn't tell me just how to... why I should have...
Then Glenn realized he was crying. It was embarrassing, but it just came up out of him, and there was no way to stop it. And that was the moment he'd realized he wasn't done mourning. In fact, maybe he'd hardly begun. A person who was done mourning didn't cry into his beer.
I was pretty much of a fuck-up, if you recall,
Glenn said, when he could talk without blubbering.
Maybe you don't know what it feels like to know what the wrong thing to do is and just watch yourself do it anyway. Like you don't even control it. But I do. My pop stuck with me through a whole bunch of times when I thought I'd end up in juvie jail.
Claude sipped his beer and nodded.
Pretty ironic that I ended up as the cop here, don't you think? I think it fits you. I think you do a good job.
Thanks, Glenn said. I try.
There was something else he wanted to say. Some other point he'd been trying to make, but the beers had finally added up and he couldn't remember. His head would have been swimming even if he was sober. And Claude had a way of making things confusingly complex.
I tell you what, Claude said at last.
Glenn could see Claude was troubled by the whole thing. Maybe more troubled than Glenn himself.
You have the power here. You know it, and I know it. And there's no point in pretending otherwise. Or thinking that you know this minute what you want to do about it. That day when you get angry is coming. When it arrives,
All I can think to offer is that you call me and we'll find a place to sit and drink some beers and talk about what to do. That's the least I could do. Hear you out.
Glenn looked at him. Claude seemed like he might be about to cry himself.
Way back when, the old guys had all the answers, Claude said. Your dad, my dad.
Yep.
We're the ones now. We've got to have the answers.
They're not all gone yet.
No, mostly, though.
Ida Payne is still around.
Claude shuddered.
Ida Payne has always been around, he said. Ida Payne will be around long after you and I are gone.
I was out to the store just last week. If anything, she's gotten creepier.
Did she say it?
Claude asked, and Glenn didn't need him to explain what he meant by it.
Did she look at you through those Coke bottle glasses and say it?
Oh, yes. Is that all?
Glenn croaked, a fair imitation of Ida's smoky voice.
Anything else?
It was funny, but neither of them laughed. You didn't laugh at Ida Payne. Claude pushed himself upright and walked to the Impala.
Remember what I said.
He fired off a drunken salute.
Okay, 10-4, roger. Over and out.
Then Claude drove off, taillights dwindling as he topped the rise south of town. Glenn didn't feel like leaving just yet. He leaned on the trunk of his car, swaying in the moonlight, and considered the dark outline of his father's shop. It was a fine summer night, the peepers all around making a melodious racket, the sky above a parade of stars and galaxies. When he was sure no one would see him do anything so maudlin, Glenn Papineau raised his bottle of Lineys to the sky and let the tears come again.
To you, Pop, he whispered. To you.
Wind. All that had taken was one paralyzing look out the rear window of Henry's sedan to realize their sojourn had ended. As soon as the train passed and the state patrol cruiser diverted onto a side street, Edgar jumped into the back seat, and for the rest of the drive he'd held Tinder and Babu in downstays, ducking and hoping that Essay up front with Henry would look unremarkable. He should never have agreed to a joyride in broad daylight. If the state patrol officer had looked at them a little longer, been a little less distracted, or had been reminded that morning of the curious bulletin outstanding for a runaway with three dogs, then the flashers atop his cruiser would have started to spin, and that would have been the end of it. By the time they pulled into the driveway, Edgar had resolved to leave at once. Henry stalled him and dug out a map and calculated the distance from Loot to Thunder Bay. It turned out to be over 200 miles. Henry pointed out the impossibility